Let's get a winner named this morning. That would be this year's Nobel Prize in Literature. And the winner is the Chinese writer Mo Yan. The Swedish Academy's permanent secretary, Peter Eglund, has this to say.
The Nobel Prize in Literature for 2012 is awarded to the Chinese writer Mo Yan, who, with hallucinatory realism, merges folk tales, history, and the contemporary.
Well, there, hallucinatory realism from a Chinese writer. To find out more about Mo Yan and his work, we turn to NPR's Lynn Neary. Good morning.
Good morning.
So earlier you told us that, now before the winner was announced, you told us that Mo Yan was a top candidate.
Indeed, he was, and China's very happy that it has turned out to be the case. A lot of people in this country may not recognize his name immediately, but he's actually one of the best-known Chinese writers in the West because a lot of his work has been translated into English, and his novel Red Sorghum was made into a film which was pretty widely seen in the West. It was made in 1987, and he's been influenced by writers like William Faulkner and the magic realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, certainly familiar writers to many of us in this country and the rest of the West. And as you just heard, in announcing the award this morning, the Swedish Academy described his writing as hallucinatory realism that merges folk tales, history, and the contemporary. His writing's also been described as experimental and unique. Other novels by Mo Yan include The Republic of Wine, Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out, and The Garlic Ballads. He's said to be so prolific that he wrote Life and Death Are Wearing Me Out, which is a 500,000-word epic, in just 43 days. He wrote it with a brush, not a computer, because he says a computer would have slowed him down because he can't control himself when he's online. He always has to search out more information.
Well, those titles are fascinating, although none of them tell us exactly what his subject matter is. What does he write about?
Well, you know, his work is mostly about peasant life set in the countryside. He often writes about the area where he grew up in Shandong province. He has said that folk literature, storytellers, his own family's stories have been a resource for him. He grew up during the Cultural Revolution. When it ended, he joined the army. And that's when he began writing. Something very interesting. Mo Yan is a pen name, and it means don't speak. And he said he took on that name because when he was growing up during the Cultural Revolution, his parents told him not to speak or to say what he really thought outside of his home. And now he says that's very ironic because he's speaking all the time.
So what do you think people will be saying in China then,
well, you know,
about this?
There's been a lot of excitement leading up to this. China has felt it's been snubbed by the Nobel Committee in the past. The only other Chinese writer to get a Nobel in Literature was actually a French citizen. And Mo Yan is the vice chair of the state-sanctioned Writers Committee. And, you know, he's actually been criticized for his tolerance of public censors in China, because in a country where writers are banned and even imprisoned, Mo Yan has cooperated with authorities. Although one literary scholar said he's an honest writer who knows how to survive in the coercive censorship of China.
NPR's Lynn Neary, thank you very much. Reporting that the Nobel Prize for Literature today went to the Chinese novelist Mo Yan. And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. You know, if I say the name Jane Austen, you may think of a number of things. You might think of novels like Pride and Prejudice or Mansfield Park. You might think of Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, a novel that was inspired by Jane Austen. You may not think about neuroscience, but you will after you hear NPR's Shankar Vedantam, who joins us regularly to talk about social science research. Hi, Shankar.
Hi, Steve.
What is the connection here?
Well, the story begins a few years ago. There's this literature professor who studies 19th century British novels, specifically Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. Her name is Natalie Phillips. She works at Michigan State University. And she's been interested in a theme that runs through many Austen novels, which is the theme of distractibility and getting distracted. And as she was thinking about this theme, it made her think about a paradox in her own life that has to do with the issue of distractibility. Here's how she put it to me.
I love reading. And I'm someone who can actually become so absorbed in a novel that I really think the house could possibly burn down around me and I wouldn't notice. And simultaneously, I'm someone who also loses my keys at least 3 times a day, and I often can't remember where in the world I parked my car. And I often feel like I'm thinking so many things at once that I lose track of what I was saying mid-sentence.
Okay, so distraction and distractibility, which sounds like the title of a little-known Jane Austen novel, come to think of it.
The one that you should write, Steve.
Okay, so she's deeply reading in a different way, a more intense way, and that makes the book feel more real than reality to her.
So this is the question, right? Why do these fictional events that took place more than 100 years ago feel more real than the real events that are happening in your own life? And what's the role of the attention that she is bringing to the novel in changing her experience of what the novel has? Now, Phillips is someone who's interested in interdisciplinary work, and so she teamed up with a bunch of neuroscientists at Stanford University to conduct this experiment where she had volunteers read a chapter of Mansfield Park, but she had the volunteers read the novel in two different ways. She had them first read the novel in this very casual way that you might do at a bookstore where you're browsing, skipping paragraphs, skipping sections.
Checking Twitter on your phone.
Checking Twitter, making sure you're updated. And then she had them read it in a very sustained and closed manner, in a very focused way. And when she talked to a neuroscientist said, look, you're probably not going to see very much difference in the brain between these two types of reading.
Everyone told me to expect these really, really minute and subtle effects because everyone was going to be doing the same thing, and they were just going to be doing it in two different ways.
That's what people expected, but what?
So she started to find some really interesting things about the brain imaging. And, you know, I should say that we're fairly early in the study. The study hasn't been completed. But what she expected was if the difference between casual reading and close reading is attention, in one case you're paying attention, in one case you're not, then the difference in the brain, areas of the brain that control attention, should be heightened in one situation.
What we found was actually something else entirely. What's been taking us by surprise in our early data analysis is how much the whole brain, global activations across a number of different regions, seems to be transforming in shifting between the pleasure and the close reading.
So wait a minute. She is saying that when you are really absorbed in a book for a sustained period of time, in a sustained way, it engages your entire brain, which is what allows you to think that you could keep reading even as the house burned down.
It looks like that. I mean, so if you step back for a second and think about brain imaging, a lot of brain imaging results are intuitively obvious. But in this situation, I think what's striking is that it wasn't just the part of the brain that focuses on attention that was different in the close reading. What Phillips is finding is that there are heightened emotional responses. There's heightened activation in the motor cortex, parts of the brain that are involved in movement, in perceiving where you stand in space. And all of these come to life when the reading is done in this closed manner with close attention.
Okay, so what are the implications for us in this world where there are constant distractions from television to email to everything else?
Well, I think what the study is showing, Steve, is that reading with half your mind is not half as good as reading with your full focused mind. And the implication for kids is, you know, you should turn off those iPhones, turn off those iPads, turn off the television. If you really want to get the experience of what a book is, you need to give yourself time to become completely immersed in it.
NPR's Shankar Vedantam here with the results of some ongoing research. Shankar, thanks as always.
Thanks, Steve.
You can follow him on Twitter at Hidden Brain. You can also follow this program at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep.
Richard Branson knew he was an entrepreneur long before he knew what the word meant. In fact, words were a problem for him in school because he was dyslexic. As Branson describes it, he was an inattentive and troublesome student. But after dropping out, the first thing he did was start a business. Sir Richard Branson went on to build a multi-billion dollar empire, from Virgin Records to Virgin Airlines, including Virgin America, also mobile phones, hotels, trains, even space travel. And he writes books of advice. The latest, Like a Virgin, Secrets They Won't Teach You at Business School, brought him into our studios in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much for joining us.
A great pleasure.
So I'm going to actually start with the dyslexia part, which you speak of in the introduction in your book. But the reason I'm curious about it is that there has actually been a study which shows entrepreneurs have a disproportionate number of dyslexics in their ranks. So I'm just curious, do you think in a strange way that turned out to be good for you?
I think so. I think by being dyslexic, I simplify everything. I calculate everything on the back of an envelope, and if it makes sense, I'll do it, and if it doesn't make sense, I won't. So I don't overcomplicate it. And I mean, I'll just give you one amusing story. I was having a board meeting and somebody gave me some figures. And I said, well, is that good news or bad news? And the director said, Richard, I don't think you know the difference between net and gross. And I owned up. I don't.
And, wow.
And so he pulled out a piece of paper and he penciled in the sea, and then he penciled in a fishing net in the sea. And he said, well, you know, the fish that are in their net, that's your profit at the end of the year. And what's outside is your turnover. Sadly, I actually thought it was the other way around. I thought we were doing much better than we were. But I suppose the interesting point about all that is it doesn't matter, you know, too much whether, you know, I mean, it's useful to be able to add up and subtract and maybe multiply. And apart from that, you know, you can create an empire with 60,000 employees and find other people to add up the numbers at the end of the year.
But I do wonder, Virgin America has received kudos for its performance. People do speak of it lovingly. But that's in contrast to some of the older domestic airlines here in the U.S., and they're burdened with legacy costs like pensions and older aging fleets. So were you burdened? Were you weighted down with the sorts of things that these legacy airlines have been weighted down with in recent years? Do you think you could have pulled that off?
I think if a company's got a great manager at the top, then they can get these issues sorted out. I mean, it's strange because in America you've got fantastic hotels, great restaurants, but the airline industry just has not gone out to make sure that every single person who flies on those planes get a wonderful experience. And the good thing about that is, you know, that leaves room, you know, for an airline like Virgin America to emerge. And, you know, we did the same thing with Virgin Atlantic when we started 30 years ago with, you know, one plane against British Airways. And the difference there is that actually British Airways did react and they did start copying what we were doing. And they did improve their game, fortunately, not as much as Virgin Atlantic, but they did improve their game. And so because you've got legacy things hanging over you, it doesn't mean that you can't get your act together.
Well, then I'd be curious about one business question that's come up in recent days. American Airlines, it's been in bankruptcy for nearly a year, and there's speculation that it might be bought or merge. What about Virgin? Are you interested?
We don't normally buy other companies or merge with other companies because you take on a lot of history. Having said that, it would be quite fun to do something with American Airlines. So, if anybody from American Airlines is listening, we'd be happy to get your call.
One chapter in your book is called Change is in the Air, Jetting to Sustainability. Tell us some main ways in which an airline, which would seem to have the hugest carbon footprint, can change that and make a difference.
Well, look, I mean, about 3 or 4 years ago, the Clinton Global Initiative, I pledged that 100% of any profits we made from our airline businesses, we would invest in alternative fuels. And what we've been trying to do is come up with a fuel that we can power our planes by that emits no carbon.
And you expect that to become a reality how soon?
I would hope that there would be enough fuel produced that, you know, most Virgin planes in 4 or 5 years' time would be flying on clean fuels.
That is something that I think nobody would have really thought possible even just a few years ago.
When we did the first test flight on coconut oil, you know, there was a lot of jokes made. But, you know, the most important thing in life is just to try these things. And we tried it. Now the American Air Force and the American Navy with their airplanes are actually flying some of their planes 100% on clean fuels already. We've got engineers and technicians all over the world working on it. It will be a reality.
You know, as I said in the introduction, you have started a mind-boggling variety of businesses, starting with Virgin Records, which, by the way, you were how old when you started?
Well, I left school at 15. My very first venture was a campaigning magazine to try to campaign against the Vietnamese War. And then from that, when I was about 16, 17, I started Virgin Records, Virgin, hence the name, 16 years old. I've discovered an artist that nobody else would put their music out called Mike Oldfield, and beautiful album called Tubular Bells, you know, which actually became very successful. And that helped us sort of build a record company that became you know, the number one independent record company in the world. And we then signed the Sex Pistols that helped propel us into the minds of people like the Rolling Stones. And a lot of these great artists were attracted and came and signed with us.
You sold Virgin Records some years ago. I mean, you don't own it at all, right?
There was something called the Dirty Tricks campaign where British Airways went to extraordinary lengths to try to drive us out of business. And as a result of, whilst this battle was going on, we had to chip in a chip, which was to sell our record company in order to give us the money to make sure that all the staff at Virgin Atlantic had their jobs secure and that Virgin Records was secure. But we're now actually beginning to go back into the music business again many, many years later. So watch this space.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for your interest.
Richard Branson's latest book is Like a Virgin, Secrets They Won't Teach You at Business School. Emma Thompson is not just an Oscar-winning actress. She's also won an Academy Award for her writing, adapting Jane Austen's novel for the film Sense and Sensibility.
Now Emma Thompson has taken on another period piece, reviving the classic children's book starring Peter Rabbit. It was the writer Beatrix Potter who first brought the mischievous bunny to life in 1902.
With tales of stealing lettuce and generally getting up to mischief in Mr. McGregor's garden. Thompson's new version takes Peter Rabbit to the Scottish countryside. Not surprisingly, it opens with our furry little hero contemplating an adventure in which he's sure to break a lot of rules.
I have not seen many rabbits moping, but when they do, their ears droop. Peter Rabbit was in low spirits. It had been a rainy summer. His blue coat had been torn by briars, and his shoes were hurting. "What I need," he said, "is a change of scene." Benjamin Bunny advised against it. "Too many carts on the road," he said. "Too many owls and too many foxes."
Regardless of the warnings from his timid cousin, Peter Rabbit soon finds himself bouncing around in a cart, heading out on yet another misadventure. The Further Tale of Peter Rabbit is the bunny's first foray into the publishing world in a century. It's also the first authorized Peter Rabbit story to be written by someone other than Beatrix Potter, and the publishers took a novel approach when approaching Emma Thompson with a proposal to bring back the bunny.
It wasn't a formal letter as such. It wasn't a, "Dear Miss Thompson, would you consider blah," from the publishers. It was a little box with two half-eaten radishes in it and a letter from Peter Rabbit. And the child part of me, I think, actually believed it had come from Peter Rabbit himself. And that got past my defences and my fear for long enough for me to say, OK, well, I'll have a go.
Now, when you were a child, your father narrated a children's show called The Magic Roundabout. And for people who might not know this, you come from an acting family, both your mother and father. And of course, he would read you Peter Rabbit books when you were a child, right?
Yes, he would. And I mean, the Potter oeuvre consists of lots of different kinds of books. Some are very much for the younger child because they've only got about two or three words on each page. And then there are the much longer sort of novel versions. So Dad, of course, being essentially wanting to get back to the football or a beer, would try to read us the very short ones. And we would beg for him to read The Tale of Mr. Todd, you know, which in bedtime story terms is only a little bit shorter than the Satanic Verses. You know, it's a lot to read at night. And I know that now because I read them to my own daughter and started to bowdlerise and cut like crazy until suddenly she stopped me. A little tiny voice said, "You left out the part about the bones." And I had. I had been cutting shamelessly because I wanted to get downstairs to my glass of Chardonnay. I admit it. I freely admit it. And from then on, I had to read the whole thing.
So why don't you read us another passage from your book? Because I want to talk to you about the language of the book. And this illustrates it a little. It's where Peter finds a very, very large radish.
Yes, it must have measured 3 rabbits round. It also smelt delicious, and Peter was very hungry. He thought no one would notice if he took a little nibble off the end. Accordingly, he scratched his way under the willow fence and took a bite, and then another, and another. By the time Peter had stopped eating, he was inside the radish. Feeling cosy, he fell asleep. When he woke up, the radish was joggling. Not again, thought Peter.
Joggling. Now there are other words. Bog, cotton, skeeps, yes. Wool. The words seem made up. I mean, they're sort of quite magical sounding. They sound like they're from another magical world.
And it's sort of also the combination of words, isn't it? Like, inside wrapped in brown paper were some excellent sandwiches of cheese and pickle. It's not the kind of construction that you get anymore. Now we say cheese and pickle sandwiches. But there's something about excellent sandwiches of cheese and pickle that's very Potteresque. It's Victorian, you know, Edwardian. It's an old form. And I find it draws me into the books still. And so I wanted to hold on to that.
I'm sorry to hit you with this, but could you please turn to page 31? I just love this little page because it has different voices.
Very good. So Peter's arrived in Scotland and having had a good night's sleep, this is just the preamble, he wakes up. So when he woke, Mrs. McBurney had made potato scones for his breakfast. "Hurry now, dearie," she said. "Today's the big day. Finlay's defending his title." "Oh, good," said Peter, not wishing to appear ignorant, even though he had no idea what defending his title meant.
Now, I would want to hear that page at least 20 times before I fell asleep. Do you by chance have any tips for parents, you know, aiming to make the most of reading the further tale of Peter Rabbit?
Yes, take it slow, much slower than you think. Give them plenty of time to look at the pictures and sort of extrapolate from the pictures. And with this book, you can do things like there's a page where he comes upon a sign which reads, "Keep out." And I've written, "I imagine it will not surprise you to hear that Peter did not keep out." And then you can pause, and most children say, "Went in." They just do, because I've tried it. I've tested it out on groups of children. He didn't keep out. What did he do? He went in, because it's the opposite of keep out, which is lovely for kids, so they can guess what he did.
Also, the picture. You see his little rabbit tail, and, of course, he's scrambling underneath the sign.
Underneath the sign, which says keep out. It's his disrespect for authority, you see. Peter's sort of anarchistic, which I love.
Emma Thompson, it's been a pleasure.
Yes, thank you so much. How lovely to talk to you.
Emma Thompson, actress and now author of The Further Tale of Peter Rabbit.
Hey, let's meet an author now who loves to show that worlds can collide and survive. Robin Sloan's first novel is called Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. It is the story of an unemployed digital designer who finds work in an unexpected place, a dusty old bookstore. As the story unfolds, the reader learns how taking time to pause and appreciate what you love can be the secret to making it in this dizzying tech-driven world. Our colleague David Green spent time chatting with the author.
In many ways, this book was a natural step for Robin Sloan. He has spent time writing short stories and time working for Twitter, where he described his job as something to do with figuring out the future of media. If you've heard of him, it might be because of his Fish Tap essay. It's a short story of sorts that's designed to be read on your smartphone. I began by asking Robin Sloan to tell me about Clay, the protagonist in his new novel.
Clay is a pretty common character here in San Francisco. He went to art school and then came out here to California to make his fortune or something, and had a brief gig as a web designer, but then like a lot of other people in the Great Recession, kind of lost that chair in the economy as the music stopped, and had to figure out what else to do. And so as the novel opens, he's kind of casting about, looking on Craigslist and even scouring the streets looking for help wanted ads, trying to figure out like what he's going to do to pay his rent and what he's going to do with his life.
Well, I do want to have you read a little bit from the opening of the book to give us a sense of Clay. I'll have you read from where he was sitting at his kitchen table looking for a job.
My name is Clay Janin, and those were the days when I rarely touched paper. I'd sit at my kitchen table and start scanning help wanted ads on my laptop, but then a browser tab would blink and I'd get distracted and follow a link to a long magazine article about genetically modified wine grapes. Too long, actually, so I'd just add it to my reading list. Then I'd follow another link to a book review. I'd add the review to my reading list, too, then download the first chapter of the book, third in a series about vampire police. Then, help wanted ads forgotten, I'd retreat to the living room, put my laptop on my belly, and read all day. I had a lot of free time.
I feel like he's someone we can all relate to. I mean, I remember times opening my laptop and within 15 minutes I'm reading something about sports and have no idea in the world why I opened my computer.
Well, you know, it's the great agony and the ecstasy of the internet today. I think we have more great stuff to read than we ever have before. But of course, the downside of that is that we have more great stuff to read than we've ever had before. And it's this crazy emerging problem that we don't know how to manage it or how to put it all in order.
Robin, one of the other characters in the book is a young woman, Kat, who works in the crazy atmosphere at Google. Tell me what role she plays in the book.
Well, there is another kind of sort of character here in San Francisco that's becoming more and more common, and it's the great Renaissance man and woman, you know, somebody who can design, somebody who can code, and somebody who, frankly, is really at the heart of these enterprises, really driving them forward. And so I wanted to kind of paint that character and help people understand why a programmer could be a really cool character and, in fact, kind of the most compelling, charismatic character in the whole story. So I decided to make her a woman, and I decided to make her work at Google, and that's Kat.
And so without giving too much away, Kat goes with Clay on this adventure. It involves using Kat's modern tools at Google to try and crack a secret code that members of a cult have been trying to solve for, oh, say, 500 years. The message from the novel is the same one that Robin Sloan has been determined to send in all aspects of his career. Soaking up all the technology and gadgets of this modern day does not mean that we have to say goodbye to the values we hold dear from the past.
And so I wanted to do something that kind of bounced back and forth between the real world and the virtual world and the new and the old in that way.
You bring them together, actually, in the Fish app. And I do want to take a quick aside and tell people about that briefly who don't know about it. I'm looking at my iPhone right now, and your Fish app, I mean, it's not really an app. It's not really an essay. It's really all together, and you just sort of read your words, and you just keep tapping to go to the next thing, and it kind of mesmerizes you. What were you trying to do with this?
You know, it's actually very similar to what I was trying to do with the novel, because if you come from the internet, as I do, I think of it as sort of my native country, there's a lot of great things happening on the internet, but one of the feelings you just can't escape is the sense that it's really hard to keep people's attention. You know, if you make a web page and somebody sticks around for 3 minutes, that's a huge success. So in the book and in the app, in the iPhone app, I was just trying to create things that would kind of capture people's attention and maybe give them a reason to stick around and engage with something for, you know, 15 minutes or 30 minutes or 3 hours or 3 days.
You're saying that novelists these days need to work harder to keep people inside a book because of the crazy world around them and all the distractions.
Well, I think it's hard to get them in, but I think it's one of the wonderful things about the novel is that once you've got them, you know, once you've got people interested for whatever reason, I think it's actually one of the last great holdouts of continuous, deep attention. You know, when I'm using the internet, I have 25 tabs open, and even if somebody sends me looking at something interesting, odds are I'll forget about it or it'll get kind of lost in the shuffle. Whereas if I find a book, especially a novel, and I make that decision to kind of sit down with it and start it, I think it gets a kind of attention, a quality of attention that's actually really rare these days. Good writing is really meaningful, and it's still one of the best tools we have to get and capture people's attention.
Why does your book glow in the dark?
Well, you know, when you're making a print book in 2012, I actually think that the onus is on you and on your publisher to make something that's worth buying in its physical edition, because there's no arguing, you know, things like Kindles and Nooks and iPads are pretty cool and pretty convenient. So if I'm going to tell somebody that they ought to go buy a physical book, I think I've got to give them a really good reason.
The challenge will be if there's a glow-in-the-dark Kindle that you'll have to come up with something else for the next one.
That's right.
Robin Sloan is the author of Mr. Penumbra's 24-Hour Bookstore. It's his first novel. Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.